Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award-winning Best Picture film in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week we're discussing Academy Award-winning film The Untouchables and Academy Award-winning screenwriter John Patrick Shanley. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We're back with another Archives.
Yeah. Woohoo.
Thanks for joining us for our 100th episode special last week.
Yeah. Woohoo. This is 101.
Yeah. On to the next 100. Of course, we have some interesting things to discuss from the year 1987. We just discussed the 60th Academy Awards. Now a little more from this year, some other winners. But before we get too far, does Bosley have a review for us today?
Bosley does. Bosley does. He, he's a prolific movie watcher.
Yes.
For those of you who are newer to the pod or don't recall, Bosley, of course, is our pup. He is named after famed film critic, Bosley Crowther, and he likes to give his own reviews in his own way of great performers of the animal variety.
Mm-hmm. I was asked in the waiting room of the vet today where Bosley's name came from.
Ah, very good. It is not the hair loss treatment, like most people ask us.
But in front of like 30 people, I had to say, oh, he's named after a New York Times film critic.
God, how pretentious. But anyways, Bosley, of course, has been very invested in the movies of the 80s, and he would be remiss to not mention one of the great dogs of the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Beasley the dog.
Beasley.
Who plays Hooch in Turner and Hooch.
Uh-huh.
It's about time we get there, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So Beasley, of course, is a very good boy.
Oh, wow.
So Beasley is a French Mastiff. When they were making the film, they hadn't decided what kind of dog they were going to use. But they didn't want to do a dog that was going to be too big or too rough, but they wanted a dog that was big and kind of slobbery and everything.
Yeah.
And they settled on the French Mastiff, and there were fewer than 300 bred in the United States at the time when the film was going to be coming out.
Oh, my.
So they did kind of a nationwide search to different rescues and breeders and things, and they found Beasley in Wisconsin. So he was purchased for the sake of the film.
Oh, wow.
This is his whole life's purpose, was to be Hooch.
Great.
He and three other dogs who were trained by Clint Rowe, who also makes a brief appearance in the film as an ASPCA officer. He was 17 months old when they got him, and he only had 5 months to train for the film. So he is a puppy.
He's young.
Yeah, he's a little guy in the film.
I mean, but he is a big guy in the film.
I mean, he's a big guy, but a little guy. He also had a stunt double named Igor, who did more of the stunts, and he did more of the acting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there was a replica of him, because I've never seen this movie, and I'm never going to watch it now, because I found out, spoiler alert, that he dies. What the heck? How dare. So I obviously will never watch this film.
Mm.
But Bosley wanted to celebrate his performance
anyways. So Bosley watched this film without you.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
okay.
What I'm saying.
Nice.
But lots of fun things happened that made his performance memorable. Tom Hanks said that he got along well with the dogs. Mm. This is what he said about it, quote, when you make a movie with a dog, you have to work with the dog for weeks prior to shooting it. Otherwise, he won't take his eye off the trainer. So I would just go off and play with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the trainer said about this, quote, in this case, we taught both Hooches to look at the person who had a little clicker that made a noise. So every time before each take, he would give Tom Hanks the clicker. Tom would click it, and then the dog would look at him.
Right.
Or the handler would have the clicker so that he would go back to him.
Mm-hmm.
They said that the hardest task to teach Beasley was two things. The first being to grab Tom Hanks by the throat. Did not want to do that.
Sure.
So that was basically impossible to do. But also to drink beer.
Oh,
because
yes.
That is a fun part of the film, of course. They were able to teach him to crack the can, but he had no interest in the beer.
Mm.
And so they ended up creating a prop that was a can with chicken soup inside.
Oh, my.
And then he was very happy
to drink
it.
You would think that they would do that first. I mean, a dog shouldn't just drink a bunch of beer.
No, I don't know what. I feel like, in a way, this was like a cutesy story. I don't know that it's like, yeah, we tried to get him to drink a beer. But one of the things that Tom Hanks talked about quite a bit was that he just had to let the dog do the dog things and he had to just react. And he thought that Beasley was great, but it was a very challenging work environment.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, because he had to like basically do improv with the dog the whole time.
I mean, yeah, that makes sense.
Yes. And so, of course, for Beasley's great performance, Bosley cracks 3 cans of chicken noodle soup for him.
Sending some up for Beasley.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Boz.
Mm-hmm. And with that, why don't you tell us about the film you're talking about today, The Untouchables?
Yeah, so I went back and forth on a lot of films.
Yeah, I didn't know you were doing this until like last night, so.
I mean, I told you before, but I was thinking about talking about Moonstruck.
Sure.
You are talking about John Patrick Shanley.
Yeah.
But after I watched The Untouchables, which I had not seen yet, I felt like it was an interesting one to talk about. We've talked about other films similar to Moonstruck being rom-coms or that sort of type of film, but we haven't really talked about a film like The Untouchables. So I just wanted to highlight it because it also, like, the whole story of it and everything around it is just important film and TV history.
Sure.
So a little recap of the film. Bureau of Prohibition agent Elliot Ness puts together an unlikely squad of men, a task force named the Untouchables, to try to take down Al Capone in Chicago during the 1930s. So it just follows the real life plot of this, mm-hmm. which I will get into as we go forward. This film had a budget of $25 million and ended up grossing $106.2 million. It was a fairly successful film that year, critically and at the box office, and ended up being nominated for numerous awards.
Mm-hmm.
The film follows the real-life circumstances and agent Elliot Ness, who helped take down Al Capone's bootlegging operations in Chicago. Shortly after he was elected, President Herbert Hoover started creating these programs to crack down on bootlegging.
Mm.
Unfortunately, none of them were quick to materialize, especially because of the stock market crash. And then attorney Frank J. Loesch of the Chicago Crime Commission reached out to the president in March of 1930, asking for his help to combat Al Capone and his gang, The Outfit. As a way to try to recover some political ground, the president decided to make bringing down Capone a top priority.
Mm.
He felt like that was something that was achievable rather than like getting financial security again for the country.
Sure, absolutely.
After many attempts to catch Capone in some kind of legal fraud or tax evasion proved unsuccessful, Elliot Ness, a 27-year-old special agent in the Prohibition Bureau, was handpicked to begin putting a team together to shut down Capone's bootlegging operations around Chicago, mostly because they wanted to start draining Capone of his financial resources to try to like get him out and prove that that was the way he was really making his money. Ness had to be very thorough in selecting his team because the amount of rampant corruption among police in Chicago and other law enforcement at the time, there ended up being around 10 core members of the team and another 10 or so who were regularly called upon if needed.
Mm-hmm.
They began to be known as the Untouchables because they were some of the only law enforcement in Chicago known for being fearless and incorruptible.
Aw.
After several agents refused large bribes from members of the Chicago Outfit, it became widely known that they were the real deal and would stop at nothing to achieve justice. And then they were named the Untouchables by Chicago Daily News reporter Charles Schwartz.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So then many articles began being written about them while they were working. They all had their own specific backgrounds and specialties, of course, like driving, flying. Some of them were expert marksmen. Some of them were really good at blending in with crowds and like getting into secret places.
This feels like a guy's bravado super dream. Like,
well,
part
and
of
it's
the
like
elite force.
Yeah, it's like real life Avengers. In
yeah,
a way.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah,
where they all have their thing, and
it's a very
all
cool idea. Yeah.
Well, and all of this, so all of this is real.
Right, I know, but it's like seems like it would be something someone would dream up.
So they raided bootlegging operations and gathered information, finally coming up with what they needed for Capone to be convicted of tax evasion, and that sent him to prison finally in Chicago. The Untouchables were mostly disbanded once he was convicted, But Ness continued to lead raids on local gangs and other bootlegging operations until Prohibition was repealed in 1933. Mm. So they were really only a thing for like a year and a half to 2 years.
Gotcha.
As Ness grew older, he and fellow untouchable Oscar Fraley wrote a book titled The Untouchables about their time together busting Al Capone. Unfortunately, Ness ended up dying of a heart attack at only 54, right after galleys of the book were approved, and he never got to see the book published. Mm. It finally came out a few months after his death in 1957. And it was a very popular book when it came out, and then it was immediately adapted as a television show that ran from 1959 to 1963 with Robert Slack starring as Ness. The show drew a lot of harsh criticism at the time from Italian Americans. Frank Sinatra was a person who really, really hated the show, as it was basically like totally negative toward all Italian Americans.
Yeah.
They were portrayed as only very violent, prone to ill will and mob behavior. It caused the Italian American League to combat defamation. That's the organization, with the help of Desi Arnaz, who was one of the main producers of the show. After many days of protesting outside the ABC studios in New York, where it was filmed, a bunch of statements were issued that the show would adhere to moving forward. Also because they had this Italian American League to combat defamation had convinced the show's main sponsor, Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company, to pull out of their deal with the show.
There it is. It's always the money.
So these were some of the main agreements that they agreed to. No more fictional hoodlums with Italian names to be featured in the production. More stress to be given to the law enforcement officer role, Rico Rossi, who was Ness's right-hand man on the show, who was
an
Italian.
Italian-American, yeah.
An emphasis will be given to the formidable influence of Italian-American officials in reducing crime, with an emphasis on the great contributions made to American culture by Americans of Italian descent. So those were the things. So this happened like in the middle of the show's run.
Gotcha.
So there were like three seasons that were produced without these, and then three or four seasons produced after this was decided. The show is sort of held up as being a landmark series for violence on television, for one.
Sure.
And then it was basically the first cop procedural.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Of course, it was a huge predecessor to later cop, FBI, SWAT type shows that have continued to exist forever.
Yeah.
Honestly, some of the most popular shows that have ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us to film producer Ned Tannen. He really wanted the life rights to Elliot Ness for a film. And of course, they were being used for television at the time. And he was a producer at Universal in the 70s and 80s. But Paramount continued to hold on to the rights of the show after it ended because they felt like they were going to reboot the show or something. He ended up leaving Universal to take over Paramount after Michael Eisner left to take over Disney. And basically the first thing he decided to do since Paramount held the rights to Elliot Ness was to start making a movie based on him.
Gotcha.
So he hired one of his producer friends, Art Linson, to start developing the movie. Linson wanted the film to be a very serious and lifelike portrayal. They didn't want it to be like... I don't know. The show was very violent, but it was more of a show. Like,
sure. Like dramatized or whatever.
And the character also of Elliot Ness was played as a, like a very hard police type. So they just didn't want that. Brian De Palma was hired at the time. He, of course, at the time is one of the foremost directors of like action and violence. Mm. So he was hired to direct. And then they hired David Mamet to start writing the script.
Oh, interesting.
De Palma also was a big writer at the time, and he did adjust a lot of things in the script, but he later downplayed his involvement, saying and talking about the film, quote, "Being a writer myself, I don't like to take credit for things I didn't do. I didn't develop this script. David used some of my ideas, and he didn't use some of them. I looked upon it more clinically, as a piece of material that has to be shaped, with certain scenes here or there. But as for the moral dimension, that's more or less the conception of the script, and I just implemented it with my skills, which are well developed. It's good to walk in somebody else's shoes for a while. You get out of your own obsessions. You are in the service of somebody else's vision, and that's a great discipline for a director." Mm. This is one of the first things that he directed that he didn't like primarily write the script on.
Mm.
He did end up changing a lot of locations, though, that they used. Like I said before, Linson wanted the character of Ness to be more vulnerable and just like more of a real person. He became sort of a family man type to add to the stakes. He was married and had a child during this time. So like they integrated that into the movie. They wanted him to be more relatable as like an everyman wanting justice, not just a cop who wants justice.
Yeah.
John Johnson was offered the role but didn't take it, as well as Mickey Rourke, Jeff Bridges, William Hurt, Harrison Ford, and Michael Douglas.
Hmm.
Some of those I would not say are like family man type, though.
Yeah.
Like Mickey Rourke does not strike me as that at all, nor Michael Douglas. Jack Nicholson ended up being announced in a Variety article as getting the role, but he didn't take it either. And then they finally gave it to newcomer Kevin Costner. Up to this point in his career, he had done very little. He had played sort of bit parts in small, like, independent films.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the scenes that he had done from The Big Chill, which would have sort of been a breakout role, ended up getting cut from the film entirely.
Oh, no.
So this was sort of like his big break, this film. Once he was cast, he began meeting with one of the former Untouchables, Al Wallpaper Wolf.
Oh, that's a good name.
Yeah, Wallpaper.
Uh-huh.
To talk about their time as a squad and to learn as much as he could about Elliot Ness, his character. Robert De Niro was De Palma's first choice for Capone, but he wasn't really sure he'd be able to do it, as he was currently in a run of the Broadway show Cuba and His Teddy Bear. He also felt that he would need to gain 30 pounds for the role because his face was not as round as Capone's was. I don't know why he was so worried about this, but that is something he was very worried about. In the meantime, De Palma called Bob Hoskins to see if he was interested in taking the part, which would be a really weird role for him.
Yeah.
It's like very serious Al Capone mob boss. So they ended up meeting together to discuss the role, and he was told he would get the part if De Niro decided to back out. When De Niro ended up taking the role, De Palma felt really bad for Hoskins, who had agreed to take the role also. So he sent him a check for £20,000 and an apology / thank you note for being willing to take the part. When Hoskins,
that is very unnecessary.
Well, when he got it, he immediately called him up to ask if there were any other parts in future movies that he wouldn't want him to take.
I mean, it's a good little scheme you got.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems very silly. I guess he just felt really bad that,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
he had him sort of, like,
on
the hook
line
for the role.
Yeah. Well, I wish more people were considerate like that.
Yeah. Of course, the film ended up having a great critical and audience response, even though it was very violent.
Mm-hmm.
Violence in movies at the time was changing, and it was being able to become more graphic and bloody.
Yeah.
As far as like gang type movies go, it's one of the ones like in the line of gang movies that is like particularly bloody.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, what about this film? 50% of the audience was women for the film.
Interesting.
Which also had not really been the case in movies that were this violent.
Yeah. Huh.
And so it's seen as sort of a turning point in film as like,
violence is for everybody.
Yeah. Al Linson commented on this after the movie's success, saying, quote, "Ordinarily, a violent film attracts predominantly men. But this is also touching, about redemption and relationships. And because of that, the audience tends to forgive the excesses when it comes to violence."
Yeah. And like leading up to this, I feel like the best examples of violence in movies is war films, which, I mean, I can't speak for all women, but at least for like myself, I just hate that kind of stuff because it's so sad and it feels so senseless and there's so rarely a sense of justice. Whereas like movies like that have like a vigilante or like some kind of street justice, it's like so much easier to get behind because you feel like things are being done for a purpose.
Well, and I will say this film does feel a lot like an Avengers type film where it's like there's a group of people coming together. It's very fun.
Yeah,
there's a lot of jazz music in the score. It's like
everything
is seen as very cool.
Yeah.
They're very like ready to go get the bad guys.
Yeah.
It's very black and white.
Which is like a human desire to watch rather than a guy's dream.
Well, but I will say the violence is very jarring because De Palma at this point is known for having very violent and extreme films. Mm-hmm. Carrie, the first Carrie.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Was one of his. Mm-hmm. Scarface, which had come out slightly before this. Mm-hmm. And so the deaths of the guys who are the untouchables are very sad and gruesome. Yeah. And some of them were seen as going very over the top, but it didn't take away from the feel good message of Kevin Costner is going to get all the bad guys.
Yeah. Well, and it's that idea of sacrifice and it's so much easier to get behind.
Vincent Canby had a really interesting article, as he always does, about some of these. He called it, quote, a smashing work. He said it was, quote, vulgar, violent, funny, and sometimes breathtakingly beautiful. He went on to say, which I think is interesting and indicative of the time that we're in, quote, the film opening today at the New York Twin and other theaters is of such entertaining order that it almost redeems Hollywood's current reputation for idiotic profligacy and total irrelevance. Which is interesting because, we were saying in our recent episodes about the Best Picture winners, they're all kind of a little bit floppy. Out of Africa and The Last Emperor don't really hold up today as films that are these are great films that everyone wants to go see. They weren't even very popular in their time. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of safe films that Hollywood was making that were just these big epics. And I don't know. It's very telling that Hollywood is sort of in a slump right now.
Mm-hmm.
Paramount was not in a slump, however. During this time is Paramount's biggest time. They were the highest grossing studio of between 1985 through 1988. Every single year they had the highest grossing. So of course another one of their films is very popular. And then this other Richard Schickel of Time magazine had this interesting quote. He said, quote, Mamet's elegantly efficient script does not waste a word, and De Palma does not waste a shot. The result is a densely layered work moving with confident, compulsive energy. Pauline Kael of The New Yorker was a little bit more harsh on the film. She didn't think it was right that it was so black and white. Because a lot of gang type movies were more gray.
Yeah.
Because they are committing acts of violence and
it's street justice, not true justice.
Right.
Yeah.
So she was kind of harsher on the movie, but all that to say, it was very well received and started leading to a lot more of the gang type movies to come about. Goodfellas comes out only a handful of years after this, which is one of the more popular films of the genre. I'll just go through what it was nominated for, and then we can move on to your topic. So the film ended up being nominated for 4 Academy Awards total. Best Supporting Actor for Sean Connery, which he won. And he was a really fun role. A lot of the praise for his role was that he played a role that was sort of the sidekick role, but it felt like he was playing it in a very original way.
Sure.
It was nominated for Best Art Direction, Best Costume Design, and Best Original Score. I thought it should have been nominated for Best Cinematography because it was just very interesting. It did get that nomination in pretty much every other award show that it was nominated for, including the American Society of Cinematographers Awards. So just goes to show that it did have very good cinematography, but it was more of a pulpy film of the era, which of course the Academy does not necessarily awarding. So it only came out with one win for Sean Connery, which I felt like he deserved for this role. He had an extremely dramatic death that was very violent and gory.
Amazing.
He crawls through his whole house bleeding out and leaves streaks of blood everywhere. So very fun. All in all, I think it's definitely one of the more important links in film history as far as, for one, the story on television is a very important link. But also for gang type genres.
And even the transition of how violence is perceived by the American public.
Yeah.
I think we've been on such a long journey for that from way back when, through the Hays Code and everything else.
And especially violence in movies that aren't war movies.
Right.
Like you were saying.
And like it makes me think about like when Bonnie and Clyde came out, how that was just such a big turning point in what films did.
Yeah. So that's a little bit about The Untouchables. Definitely seek this movie out if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's Brian De Palma is very good, obviously, as a director. But yeah, it's great. A good 80s film.
Yeah, nice.
So why don't we shift gears a little bit and hear some about John Patrick Shanley.
Yeah. So in looking over this year and deciding what to talk about, that could mean like, you're going to talk about Cher, right? You're going to talk about Cher. And I was like, I don't know how to talk about Cher.
Well,
she's too big of a presence.
Traditionally, you talk about the woman who wins Best Actress.
I know. I like the ladies. That's like my favorite thing. But I didn't want to talk about Cher because she's too prolific in other things that are not Academy related. But with that, I, as a theater kid, I figured I would talk about John Patrick Shanley because he wins Best Original Screenplay for Moonstruck this year.
Yeah.
And I don't really think I'll talk about him when we get to Doubt.
Sure.
There's going to be so much more to talk about that year. So I figured this is my chance.
Great.
So just like a little bit of an overview for those of you who may not be super familiar with him. He is like one of the most prolific modern American playwrights. Mm-hmm. He's still working. Like he's one of the few people that consistently turns out great shows, great scripts, and has become like a name, like a Tennessee Williams in America kind of a person. He won the award for original screenplay for Moonstruck. And then, of course, his play Doubt really exploded. He won the Pulitzer Prize, the Tony. He also wrote the film adaption and earned a nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay for that. Also, he is the author of over 23 plays that have been translated and performed all around the world. It averages that there are about 80 productions a year in North America of his shows.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
Yes. Isn't that insane?
Wow.
And he's pretty much always directed his own productions, the premieres of them or the first workshops or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but the majority. Some of the ones you may be familiar with are, of course, Doubt, Outside Mullingar, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, which was his second play. I didn't realize that. So early on in his career.
Interesting.
1983.
Huh.
There was just a recent revival of that. It's a great play. Oh my gosh. Beggars in the House of Plenty, Four Dogs and a Bone, Defiance, Prodigal Son in 2016, which Timothée Chalamet originated the role in. And of course, his films are far less notable. He did, of course, write Moonstruck. He wrote and directed Doubt. And then most recently, Wild Mountain Time, which is kind of an adaptation of Outside Mullingar.
But not nearly as successful.
And not very good.
Yeah.
He's also an Emmy nominee for writing Live from Baghdad.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But all that to say, he's had an interesting life. He was born October 13th, 1950 to an Irish-American family in the Bronx. At the time and throughout most of his life, it was considered a very rough neighborhood. And that has really informed a lot of his work. He really struggled in school, but not because he wasn't smart, just because he was so, you know, fiery, whatever, as some kids are. When he wrote his bio for the play Doubt, when it was premiering, he referenced it that he was thrown out of St. Helena's kindergarten, banned from St. Anthony's hot lunch program, and expelled from Cardinal Spellman High School. But he still loved school.
Yeah.
Like he loved the institution. He just wasn't good at it and he just misbehaved, you know? He was very inspired in his younger years by one of the nuns that was at his school, Sister Margaret N.T., who he ended up basing the role Sister James on, who is like one of the main characters in Doubt, played by Amy Adams in the film.
Yeah.
And then also while he was at Cardinal Spellman High School, he saw a couple of productions that really influenced his life. The foremost being Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, interesting.
He loved it. It told him that he could be a poet. And he, especially as a teenager, just felt like Cyrano, like he didn't fit in, he was a lover, that he he like, and he like talks about this a lot in his life. He said, quote, I was in the Bronx. I was like, I want to be a poet. That is just about the most unrealistic thing a kid whose father is a meatpacker and whose mother is a telephone operator could come up with. What's more, I didn't just want to be any poet. I wanted to be Cyrano de Bergerac. I wanted to be a poet who was also a vigorous, masculine presence in the world. I did feel grotesque, which is why I identified with Cyrano, in part because just aspiring for things was not in the particular world that I happened to be inhabiting.
Interesting.
Which, I mean, how many teenagers see Cyrano de Bergerac and are like, yes!
I don't know. Very few, I would assume.
He did end up going to school. He was accepted at New York University, but he was put on academic probation while he was there. And during that time, he decided to enlist in the United States Marines during the Vietnam War. So he did go do his military service. He wrote a novel about it. He burns the novel. And then he returns back to school with the help of the GI Bill.
Oh, interesting.
So there's a lost novel out there about his time in the war that I don't know why that happened. He ended up graduating from NYU as the valedictorian in 1977.
Wow, good for him.
This is why I'm saying it's all about him. Like it's
right.
It's the amount of effort and energy he puts into it that is what he gets out of it. So the main thing I want to talk about today is Moonstruck. I'm not going to really talk about his plays or other things like that because obviously this is the Academy Awards podcast, so that's what matters. When he wrote Moonstruck, previously he had written about 6 to 7 plays that had done fairly well. He didn't have a ton of acclaim in the film industry. He like hadn't really worked any in the film industry at all, but his productions were doing great on Broadway. He was a member of the Ensemble Studio Theater, which is pretty much where all of his stuff was workshopped and then produced. And so because of this, he did have some connections that were pretty good. He knew Norman Jewison.
I mean, that's a great connection.
Like, he didn't know him personally, but he knew of him and had other, you know, second, third degree, whatever, relationships. So he wrote Moonstruck as a screenplay, and he sent it to him. And Norman Jewison pretty much immediately said, yes, like, this is fun. This is great. I want to do it. So he invited him to come to Toronto to work on it together. So when John Patrick Shanley writes his screenplays, he talks about them quite a bit, that he only writes them on spec. So he can't be coerced into any kind of rewrites. He doesn't want to, like, change it. He writes the screenplay, and then he's like, this is what you get. Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
And he really liked working with Norman Jewison. They had a really great partnership. And I just want to talk about a little bit of like the stuff that they worked on. Also, when he sent it to him, he had titled Moonstruck The Bride and the Wolf, which they ended up changing, which I thought was like a very kind of a cool title, but totally different.
Well, and it definitely would not have been as popular with that title.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Also, just a funny thing about John Patrick Shanley that he talks about quite a bit is that he is obsessed with the moon.
Oh.
Yeah. He just like loves it. And if you think about that
it's
and think about
his stuff.
There's a lot. And one of the reasons that he talks about this quite a bit is that he talks about how in the sun, everything is plain and clear. But in the moonlight, there's shadows and romance and you don't quite know what you're seeing, and he loves the mystery, and he's always been obsessed with the moon and the night and
interesting.
Very similarly, he's also very obsessed with animals. He loves animals and animal imagery, which again is very prevalent in many of his works. All different types of animals, from the bumblebee to the wolf. Some of you may know what I'm referencing. But back to Moonstruck, a lot of this is pulled from an interview that he did with Roger Ebert when Norman Jewison passed. One of his quotes was, quote, the first thing we did to prepare to shoot the movie was Norman and I got together and he told me we were going to do a reading, the two of us, and divide up the parts. I'd read us half of them and he'd read us half of them. We threw ourselves into it. And in the big scene where Ronnie tells her, now I want you to go upstairs with me and get into my bed. I was Ronnie and he was Loretta and we played it, man, like our lives depended on it. And he agreed to go upstairs with me. And so I'm just like picturing the two of them having the time of their lives, like acting out this. I mean, and if you've seen the movie, it is so dramatic.
Yeah.
I mean, how fun. That's how great art is made. And that is the theater artists, you know? He did get to be a little bit involved in like the rehearsals, but he showed up on the first day and Norman Jewison kind of looked at him and was like, thanks for dropping by. And like, And he says about this that he was like, I didn't really know what that meant. I wasn't quite sure. And then after a little bit of sticking around at the rehearsal, he was like, oh, he doesn't want me to hang around. Yeah. So he ended up deciding to just trust. And this was a challenge for him because mm-hmm. he'd been very, very involved in his theaters, like his theater scripts productions, right. In bringing them from the page to the stage. And so he realized that like he had to just trust the process and that filmmaking is different. Mm-hmm. This was a new adventure.
Well, and normally writers in theater are way more involved yes. in production.
Especially the first. Yeah, absolutely. And so he stayed close to where they were filming. A lot of it was in Toronto. But he decided to not be involved and he would just let Norman Jewison call him up as needed. But he really did want to be a part of things.
Yeah.
And Norman Jewison knew this. Yeah. And so Norman Jewison did invite him to come the day they were shooting at the Lincoln Center for the opera.
Nice.
So he got to go. He got to be like kind of in the crowd a little bit. And he just like really had fun with that. He said it was one of the coldest nights of the year. And one of the things that happened the night he was there was that Nicolas Cage didn't want to say all of the speech that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he was kind of glad that he was there because they got to go back and forth about it. They debated it and then eventually came to a conclusion on what he would say, which ultimately is how things go in the theater. You know,
right.
But half of the fun of being a playwright in the theater is workshopping your script, because when you're working with the actors, you get to like determine what works and what doesn't work. I mean, that's the best part of the process. In talking about this particular script, he was very enamored with the idea of like, and this is something that comes through in many of his plays as well, is that there's one person out there for you. And if you find them, things will fall into place. But he also is very interested in the idea of people disenchanting other people. This is his quote about it. He said, people say, quote, you have to be realistic. You're not going to get everything you want. My reaction is like, why not? Why ain't I going to get everything I want? Now, of course, life can stand in the way. Many things can happen to make that the case, but not some person who's just saying you have to be realistic, because I don't know what realism is. I know that being what many people call unrealistic led me to a much more interesting life in the real world than the people who were telling me that I had to be realistic.
Huh.
Which, I mean, this is also a theme in many of his plays too, that he loves this kind of fairy tale-esque quality, kind of a little bit of magical realism. And Moonstruck is a very good example of this, where like the story is very grounded. It is grounded in a very classic American neighborhood in New York, normal family, normal people. And yet you have these like kind of absurd things, the moon and the monologues they say and the proclamations of love. And Moonstruck, for those of you who may not be familiar with the movie, is meant to be perceived as an opera.
Right.
That's how he has written the script, is that like they go to see the opera, but also the whole story is an opera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the Italian style opera that he loved as well. So you have like the characters that are in love with each other, and then the one goes away and it's everything falls apart and everybody's mismatched Shakespearean operatic style. You know, it's so fun.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things that he really wanted to integrate into the story. And so another thing that's fun in the script is that all the places are fairy tale-esque. So you have the Cinderella Beauty Shop, the Sweetheart Liquor Store. And by doing this, he said, quote, I'm telegraphing something when I'm doing that, that we are in a world where everyone is affected by or in love. So, you know, just very... full circle, you know? The other thing that he's often criticized for about this film is the language. It's very heightened. It almost feels silly at times. And about this, he has said over and over that he did not care. And he talks about one time that he was on the train and he was thinking about this because he was like, well, should I like try to make it, quote, more realistic, you know, down to earth, whatever. And as he was sitting there, he'd heard two women on the same train in the Bronx talking. And they were talking exactly the way all the characters in the film talk.
And I was going to say, like, it doesn't sound strange to me. It also is like any other rom-com. Like,
right, yeah.
Most rom-coms are this way, where all the characters speak in slightly heightened language because everything is heightened.
Right, that's the beauty of a rom-com. That's why we want to jump into that world, because it's larger than life.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, Also, one thing that I think he identifies a lot in his work, but a lot of playwrights talk about, is this idea that like life is big. Like when one of the things in, you know, theater school, when you're in school, is like you have this tendency as an actor or a writer or whatever to tamp down your emotions when you're performing. Mm-hmm. But that's not real. When your best girlfriend gets engaged, you jump up and down and you scream and you be silly and you dance and you say stupid things. Whereas like when you're acting, it's so hard to let yourself unleash that mm-hmm. and to talk the way you want to talk or the way you would talk in real life because it feels too big and you want to be small and grounded. And he just doesn't believe in that.
Yeah.
Last thing I just wanted to mention is that he really tried to create a world with this film that is similar to his experience of growing up in the Bronx. Mm. He talks about his life and experience and he said, quote, I would go to the Italian-American households and the woman serving me dinner had three buttons on her blouse undone and was handing me a big bowl of pasta. And I was like, this is a lot better than what is going on in my house. So I took everything from my household, which was very good talk and intellectual rigor of a kind, and then everything from the Italian-American household to build something new.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So anyways, I mean, I am a very big John Patrick Shanley fan. I think his work is very remarkable. And I don't really have too much to say about him as a person. I didn't really find too much like either praise or critique of him and his personality.
Yeah, I mean, most writers are pretty private.
Yeah, that's kind of the gist I was getting. And also like he's very much a person who wants his work to stand for itself and he puts himself into his work. And
right.
So I think as far as like defining him as a person, you have to look to his work to do that
mm-hmm.
and to see what his values are and to see what he thinks about the world. But that's what I have to share today about playwright and Academy Award winning screenwriter, mm-hmm. John Patrick Shanley.
Wow. Congrats to him. And of all the films to win for, like, this is a great film to win for.
Absolutely.
The script is very singular in the film.
Yeah.
Particularly this one.
Yeah.
And like, it's both the same and very different from rom-coms that came before.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we've gone into rom-coms in depth in other episodes, particularly Annie Hall, which is like the first major modern rom-com
mm-hmm.
and the last rom-com to win, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Best Picture. But yeah, it's just an interesting, like The Untouchables, an interesting link between classic Hollywood type rom-com stuff and the more modern rom-coms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've talked about my own taste many times on this podcast, but I just love like the indie comedy rom-com mm-hmm. style. And I don't love Moonstruck. Like it's not it's not my cup of tea per se. Same thing with Annie Hall. I mean, I talked very extensively about my like nuanced opinion on that. But I just love these points in Academy history where it's like, wait a second, there's something going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that is blossoming into another genre. What's it going to be? And this is, like you were saying with The Untouchables, I think this is another very important link in another facet of film history.
Yeah. Yeah. The 80s are such a strange time to me in film history now because things are changing very rapidly for so many reasons. And the groups of people are switching over and a lot of the old guard is dying out again. And the new Hollywood, who are people like Coppola and Spielberg and Lucas, and they've been in Hollywood now for over a decade.
Now. Yeah.
And they are, I mean, not necessarily Coppola, but they're like hitting their strides as far as like, you know, they've created this new Hollywood.
Yeah. And they've earned the trust to get the money, to get the stuff to make the movies and have the people they want in the movies. And yeah, their own careers are beginning to boom, which is allowing newer things to sneak in that struggle spot that they were previously in.
Well, and it's making way for directors like James Cameron, who only make huge, epic, like insanely high budget movies that are like the blockbusters of all blockbusters. So, yeah, an interesting time.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to our final segment of the show in which we thank the Academy for things relating to the films that we discuss, the people that we talk about, and these years in film. What would you like to thank the Academy for today, Kristen?
First, I would like to thank the Academy for being included in your movie. I really like this idea of, and I'm just making up the story in my own head, of John Patrick Shanley, like, being present and wanting to be involved and then kind of getting the hint, like, oh, no, I need to go back to my hotel room and, like, doing his thing. And then Norman Jewison being like, ah, this guy, he wants to be involved. Come on to the opera. And, like, just the, like, joy and excitement of that.
Yeah.
I just think that's lovely.
I will thank the Academy for a Kevin Costner film that I can stand him in.
Oh, gosh.
For some reason, he's known as kind of being like, I don't know, when we get to Dances with Wolves, we'll end up talking about him a lot more, obviously, for very obvious reasons, which is a film that is like highly looked down upon as like one of the worst winners in film history.
Mm.
And like best picture winners. But I found him to be very good in The Untouchables.
Okay.
He didn't do anything weird. He was just normal. He was very like Chris Evans-ish.
Oh.
Vincent Canby even said he reminded him of Montgomery Clift, which
wow,
I thought was
high
like
praise.
Very high praise. I don't think I wouldn't go that far. He felt way more like a modern actor who was just kind of like good looking, normal. You don't think too much about him.
Yeah.
He's just doing his thing and being a good guy.
Gotcha.
So
I would like to thank the Academy for acting out your own script to sell it.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorite pastimes.
Yeah.
We've heard of many a director
or producer
who's losing his mind and has to perform for everybody. And I like this one because it's kind of a private performance of the two of them, but still impactful.
Yeah. Another Hollywood tale as old as time. I would like to thank the Academy for efficient scripts.
Okay.
So I felt like this script that he won for, Shanley, is a very efficient script.
Agreed.
Gets right to the point.
Yeah.
And the same was said of David Mamet's script for The Untouchables.
Two American playwrights.
Yeah.
The definition of later America.
Uh-huh.
And writing their snappy scripts. It's because they know that you can't just meander.
Yeah.
Theater is not a meandering business. And so you have to full circle your scripts, get it done, give
and
the actors some breathing room.
They both have such distinct styles,
yes,
too.
Yes, definitely.
You know a David Mamet script when you're reading it.
Yes.
You know a John Patrick Shanley script when you're reading it.
Yeah.
And both of these, I feel like, are good representations of their work.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And with that, we leave you.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us for the past 100 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for continuing to listen. If you feel so inclined and you really like the show, give us a rating and review.
Yeah.
It really helps get us boosted in the old algorithms, puts us in front of more eyeballs and ear holes.
Oh, gosh.
So do that if you're so inclined. And then join us next week where we discuss the 61st Academy Awards and the 61st Best Picture winner, Rain Man.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and Thank Academy Pod on X. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platforms. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Heisinger. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.